on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taken to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
Today is Friday, July 6th. I'm Chirag Mahajan.
And I'm Brad Winter. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from the University of British Columbia, to our UBC campus, to the residents of Vancouver, and to listeners of our newscast and podcast on our website, citr.ca/listen.
Good evening. It is 5:12, and apologies for the delay. Nardwar was before us and played an amazing cassette show. It's now time for another semi-full hour of independent news. Our headlines will cover news from the UBC campus, local news from Metro Vancouver, provincial and federal news from across Canada, as well as news from around the world. We also had a chance to talk to Tim Meyer, head of communications at the Triumph National Laboratory for Particle and Nuclear Physics here at UBC, about the recent discovery of a Higgs-like particle at the LHC in CERN, Switzerland.
All this, plus your weekend weather forecast right here on News 101, your source for independent news. Now it's time for your UBC campus and local headlines.
In the last week of June, it was announced that University of British Columbia students and postdoctoral fellows in the fields of geochemistry, quantum sciences, and information and communication technology systems received a $4.9 million boost from the Natural Sciences and Engineering Research Council of Canada, the NSERC. Three NSERC Collaborative Research and Training Experience Grants, or CREATE Grants, of $1.65 million each over 6 years, will prepare young science and engineering researchers for careers in industry, government, and academia. John Hepburn, Vice President of Research and International, said that, quote, "The CREATE Grants are instrumental to supporting the professional and technical skill development of graduate students as they pursue innovative and interdisciplinary research at UBC. We are grateful to NSERC and the Government of Canada for supporting young researchers as they work towards their future careers," end quote. UBC's three CREATE grants are part of a $28 million investment for 17 projects announced on June 26th by Gary Goodyear, Minister of State for Science and Technology in Waterloo, Ontario. Since the program's inception in May 2008, UBC has received 10 CREATE grants.
And the Vancouver Park Board is considering completing a gap in the city's seawall between Kitsilano and Jericho beaches after a private donor has offered to kick in tens of millions for the project. Although the financing for the seawall would be shared between Vancouver taxpayers and this anonymous private donor, any construction will be subject to public consultation in Vancouver and federal approval, since the foreshore is technically Ottawa's jurisdiction. Though Mayor Gregor Robertson hasn't lent his support to the concept, it is sure to generate controversy, as it may require altering the shoreline in front of some of Vancouver's most expensive real estate. As a result, some have made claims that this proposal may threaten one of the few remaining intertidal marine habitats in the city. A UBC marine ecologist, Jamie Slogan, said that proper foresight by City Council could help mitigate the negative consequences. Slogan recommends that the council considers building a riprap, which is a type of foreshore construction with concrete rubble or pitched man-made rock, which will help replicate the existing habitat. Vancouver City Councilor and former longtime Kitsilano resident Adrian Carr believes a seawall extension would add both a safe bike route and valuable walking path. On the plus side, connecting the Jericho and Kitsilano waterfronts with an approximately 2.5 kilometer walkway would create a continuous seawall that stretches from Point Grey to False Creek and Stanley Park. Carr added that while the area is popular for mollusks, sea stars, crabs, and algae, there is no active fish run along the foreshore in question. However, like Slogan, Carr believes the seawall extension project must involve care and attention towards intertidal species. Vancouver Park Board Chairwoman Sarah Blythe said on Wednesday that the project would be put through a public consultation process.
Vancouver Police will hold its first ever women's safety fair designed to give women the tools to protect themselves and raise awareness about community resources. The fair will feature numerous information booths by community groups and a women-only personal safety demonstration by the Vancouver Police Department. According to VPD stats, there have been 143 cases of sexual assaults in the first 3 months of 2012. Anna Foschi, with the Vancouver Lower Mainland Multicultural Family Support Services Society, said it is essential for women and their children to have awareness and knowledge of community resources and how to access them. Sergeant Colleen Yee of the Sex Crimes Unit said that, quote, "At the heart of the presentation, we're going to be teaching awareness of environment mindset and some physical skills that are simple enough to learn and understand just to get out of a questionable or dangerous situation." End quote. Yee also said the fair follows the success of the VPD's Don't Be That Guy campaign last year. The Women's Safety Fair will be held at the Trout Lake Community Center at 3360 Victoria Drive on Saturday, July 7th from 1 p.m. to 4 p.m.
And now it's time for our interview with Tim Meyer, Head of Communications at the TRIUMF National Laboratory for Particle and Nuclear Physics here at UBC, about the recent discovery of a Higgs-like particle at the LHC in CERN. This interview was conducted by reporter Nina
Carizia.
Nina Carizia.
TRIUMF Lab here at UBC. Hi, Tim.
Hi, good morning.
So, tell us a little bit about the Higgs boson particle.
Yeah, so we've had a big breakthrough with the observation of a brand new particle that we think is the missing piece to the standard model. And the Higgs boson is a special particle. It's actually been part of the description of how we understand the subatomic world for almost 35 years when it was first imagined to exist. And it really is the last component that was required to say that all of the machinery that we use to make calculations about chemistry and physics, we actually have observed all the elements that drive those calculations. So this Higgs boson is the validation that there actually is an energy field which is giving mass to all particles. So as particles move in the standard model, they should all be traveling at the speed of light. And in fact, they should have zero mass. It's only when we introduce the Higgs mechanism, which allows those particles to interact with sort of like molasses as they're traveling along, that they slow down. So the Higgs mechanism is akin to why it's harder to push a heavy box than a light box. And this has all these subatomic particles experience mass and slow down by interacting with the Higgs field. So this observation and the announcement by the 6,000 physicists involved in both collaborations is really, it'll be the discovery, maybe not of the century, but certainly of the past 30 years. This is a huge accomplishment.
Yeah, so my understanding, it's a particle, but the way you're explaining it, it had to do with energy. Like, I didn't really understand. So it is a particle.
Yeah. So what we the way things work in particle physics is that you think about the surface of a lake. There's water there, and if it's a calm day, it's smooth. But when you see waves, that's really just a periodic. We call it an excitation, or it's a disturbance on the surface of the water. In fact, it's very hard to set up a wave in, say, a solid piece of ice because it's solid. Yeah. So we can actually learn a lot about the lake by looking at the structure of the waves on the surface. In a similar way, a particle is like the wave on the surface of that other medium. So when we say we've seen the Higgs boson, we've actually seen a particle, but it also allows us to infer that there's an energy field there which has an excited state, which is the particle that we observed.
Okay, so I know they've been looking, they were studying this at the CERN for a while, mm-hmm. and I'm just wondering, what's the significance of the finding? Why were they trying so hard to find something when immediately it doesn't make any big difference?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Exactly. Does this discovery change, you know, what you're going to have for breakfast tomorrow? Absolutely not. But I think there's sort of two sides to the coin to respond to that. And one is, you know, ever since, you know, humans first came out of the caves and looked up at the night sky, they're curious and we're interested and we're sort of on this, call it a spiritual or an intellectual or a cultural quest, like, you know, what is the universe that we're in and how does it work and what is our role in it? So part of the quest for understanding what happens inside the atom and what happens at the most microscopic scale and what happens of a second after the Big Bang is just that curiosity of actually understanding and marveling at how our world actually works.
Exactly, yeah.
I think and then the other thing is, of course, you know, where science is sort of a public pursuit is that these types of quests to understand these seemingly obscure questions really challenge our technologies. And then as we become more skilled and build new tools, we develop side benefits that actually have the real-world impact. So CERN was actually the place that developed the World Wide Web and those protocols, but had nothing to do with e-commerce. They were trying to share data between particle physics experiments.
Oh, wow.
And then 5 to 8 years later, bam, you've got the Internet and you've got, you know, Pizza Hut delivering pizza from a website.
Yeah. So when you were talking about the Big Bang, so this, what role would the Higgs boson have in the Big Bang?
Yeah, so, you know, after the Big Bang, which is when we say it all started, you know, the universe was expanding and this massive, dense, hot energy ball was expanding, it should have just continued being energy. And we would just have a universe that's filled with some diffuse energy. And it's the Higgs mechanism that actually allows, as that energy expands and cools, that there's actually some mass. You remember E equals mc squared from Einstein. The question was, well, why is there an m and how did the m get there? And the Higgs mechanism and the Higgs particle is actually the mechanism, and it's actually the reason
that
we ended up with matter in the universe. So without the Higgs mechanism, we wouldn't have our world. So the Higgs boson is that missing piece that says, you know what, we think we do understand how this works, and now we have a consistent description.
So that's where the God particle came from.
The God particle is a bit of a misnomer. It actually came from an argument between a Nobel laureate and his book publisher about how to title a book. Leanne Letterman said, we've been looking for this particle, it's the keystone, and it's hard to find, it's a goddamn particle. And the publisher said, we can't put that on the front of the book, let's call it the God particle.
That's how that starts. So it didn't even start from just another way of saying it.
No, it didn't even start as a holy grail or anything. It was actually someone cursing about the challenges.
So that's why scientists very much dislike that name for it.
Yeah, I would say we're never going to live it down, but in the grand scheme, you know, people seem to smile when they hear it, so what the heck.
And
you know?
I feel like it's helped people kind of understand what it is when you say God particle. It's like, oh, okay, like it started life.
Yeah,
nice
it is truly. Yeah, and in some sense, you know, some people call it's, you know, the Holy Grail, just like, you know, the search for the Ark of the Covenant or something. You know, it's a quest that takes generations.
Yeah.
I mean, we've been building experiments and developing tools to work on this for decades. And so it is this sort of quest. And, you know, one of the really powerful moments was Peter Higgs was actually at the announcement in Geneva. We were watching this live by video conference at midnight. and he was really moved when they announced they'd actually discovered this particle. And then, you know, he had tears in his eyes. This has been something that's really important and significant, and you can imagine what it's like to know that this somewhat obscure idea is actually looks like it's how it actually happens in reality.
Of course, and he was the one who hypothesized it, I think, in the 60s?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's been quite some time.
So why has it taken so long to find?
Well, there's the real situation is we thought this mechanism in the particle existed, but we didn't actually know how heavy the particle itself was. So we thought there was this energy field, but, you know, the question is, you know, how big is the wave on the surface of the lake, and how You know, do you need a really strong wind to get the wave, or can you just throw in a pebble and get that wave? By analog in particle physics, we collide our beams of particles at higher and higher energies to see if we can create that particle. And the Higgs boson is, we see now, this particle weighs about 125 to 126 GeV. That's 130 times the mass of the proton. So it's a very heavy particle. We actually did not have the technology to create collisions that had enough energy to produce that particle. So it really has been the march of accelerators and detectors and computing that's allowed us to create the conditions where we could temporarily create a Higgs particle and then observe it.
Okay, so it's about collisions between...
We're colliding beams of protons at the Large Hadron Collider in CERN. So we're actually stripping out the core of atoms, accumulating them in bunches, and then firing, you know, trillions of these protons at each other. Occasionally they collide. Occasionally they produce a Higgs boson, and occasionally we observe it. So it's a...
Wow. So it's a... That's very, very cool. That sounds like a...
Yeah, they say it's not a needle in a haystack, you know, it's even worse than that. So.
Yeah, exactly. So just for the future of this, is there anything that you could do with this discovery that they're planning to do with specifically knowing now that the Higgs boson exists?
Well, there's two things. I'd say that, you know, is the Higgs boson going to change your breakfast in 15 years? And it's unlikely that the Higgs boson itself, or, you know, if this particle has something else to it. But I think what we can say is that we've now validated a description of subatomic physics. And this is the same description that's used to develop new semiconductors. It's the same description of calculations that are used to look at nanotechnology and quantum computing. So we really are starting to master this mathematical framework for understanding a lot of the emerging technology. So having observed the Higgs boson, we now have more confidence in that basic description.
Yeah.
The other side of it is that we're not going to study the heck out of this particle, because technically speaking, we've observed a particle that looks very much like the Higgs boson. Have we proven this is the bad boy? Not quite yet. We got to make sure we get its name, rank, serial number, and what it eats for breakfast, and you know, who it hangs out with. And then we'll say this is that particle. But as we study the heck out of it, we're actually going to be stretching into some of the questions we still don't understand. So I said we had this great calculation tool, the standard model. It works great for quantum computing and nanotechnology and particle physics, but it doesn't actually explain the night sky.
Yeah.
And so by looking at this Higgs boson, we may actually finally have a breakthrough that says, we're good, and here's where we're absolutely wrong. And that may actually change everything, if we actually understand why antimatter is the way it is, as opposed to just saying, well, we see it that way.
Yeah, well, yeah, validating, of course. It's not just hypothesis anymore,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Which Higgs must be very, very proud of.
Yeah, yeah. And it's ironic. One of the questions they asked him is, you know, well, you know, what do you think about them calling it the Higgs particle? And his comment is that, you know, it wasn't just him that came up with this model of this energy field, this molasses that slows things down. There's sort of six people involved, and he says, you know, it shouldn't really call it the Higgs mechanism. There's these six guys that are involved. But you know what? He says, I really do feel like I'm the one who's been working for 30 years to say we should look for this particle.
Yeah.
So he's actually delighted to consider it the Higgs particle, because he thinks that's part of his contribution to saying, let's look for this thing, as opposed to just call it a good idea and move on. So.
Yeah. And I mean, it's not a popularity contest anyway. It's
right.
Science, but that's awesome.
Yeah, yeah.
Awesome.
I think the final thing I'd just say is this is the other thing that's really exciting. It's a global effort. I mean, all the way from
exactly.
UBC and UVic and Simon Fraser and Triumph to St. Mary's to, you know, there's 6,000 scientists from around the world, 137 countries. You know, and
of course, as you're saying this, I'm thinking now if only we could all get along in other aspects.
Yeah, and that's, you know, that's one of the reasons I still work with particle physics, is because it's one of the few places that Israelis and Palestinians and Arabs and Jews and Germans and Americans and Canadians, if you bring up science, they're all going to sit down and work on it together. And you know, it's inspiring. It's like if we can work on that together, you know, there's hope.
There is. No, really.
We will survive. We can.
Awesome. Yeah. Tim, thank you so much for talking to us.
All right. Thank you very much. Have a great day.
You too.
Care.
Bye.
Bye.
And thank you to Nina Carigia for conducting that interview with Tim Myers, the head of communications at Triumph National Laboratory for Particle and Nuclear Physics here at UBC, about the recent discovery of a Higgs-like particle. We're going to take a quick break, but do stay with us for your weekend weather forecast.
On July 7th, a Loving Spoonful will host their signature annual fundraiser, Project Empty Bowl. Presented by Coast Capital Savings and hosted by Global TV's Deborah Hope, this evening of fabulous food and fun will raise badly needed funds to provide meals to men, women, and children living with HIV/AIDS in our community. This evening will feature gourmet cuisine served in hand-crafted souvenir bowls that attendees can take home with them, paired with Peller Estates wines and Russell Brewing Company beer. The event will also feature a silent auction, as well as live art auction, featuring a number of one-of-a-kind pieces donated from Arthur Erickson's personal collection. Tickets are only $85 before June 24th and $100 after. They can be purchased online at alovingspoonful.org or by calling 604-682-6325.
Welcome back to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca, broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia to Vancouver and the internet. And now we have your weekend weather forecast brought to you by Phil Chang, our weatherman from the UBC Storm Club. Hi, Phil. Hello, Phil. Could you hear us? Hello? Hello? We are having some technical difficulties here, but we're going to take a quick PSA and be right back.
Town at UBC Summer Festival is taking place Saturday, July 7th. Join in the summer fun and get to know your U-Town at UBC community. The main event takes place at Spencer Field, 11 a.m. until 3 p.m. Come and enjoy games like bingo and giant Jenga, have your face painted, and take part in a community art project. There will be entertainment throughout the day and a delicious barbecue, plus skating at Thunderbird Arena and a free aquatic play day at the Aquatic Center. For more information, go to planning.ubc.ca/summerfestival. Sponsored by CITR 101.9 FM.
The alphabet has only 26 letters. With these 26 magic symbols, however, millions of words are written every day.
Yes.
This month in Discorder, check out part 2 of our Summer Festival preview, which indulges you in the folky, the hippie, the eclectic, and the electronic. Discorder sits down with Hot Panda to talk about things like hot sauce, writing food blogs, and the ultimate battle for panda greatness. We also talk with the V Vecker Ensemble, who are the Captain Planet of Vancouver indie music. We talk with Ryan Smith of Green Burrito Records of the value of cassette tapes, and experience Sasquatch Music Festival through the eyes of Discorder. Don't forget to check out our regular columns like Filmstrip, where we review the film Better Than Something. Check out our events calendar for all the greatest upcoming shows, and our art project focusing on the work of Aaron Moran. You'll find the greatest in both recorded and live music in our Under Review and Real Life Action sections. All this and more in the July issue of Discorder, that magazine from CITR, on stands now.
Welcome Welcome back to News 101. Sorry for that technical difficulty, but we now have Phil Chang with our weekend weather forecast.
All right. Good evening, listeners. Taking a look at our UBC's very own Earth, Ocean, and Atmospheric Science Department's rooftop weather station, we see that no precipitation is anticipated for this entire weekend. This makes sense, as the station is also predicting a steady high pressure over us, which will effectively prevent local cloud formation by pushing down on the surface air parcels trying to rise due to the warm temperatures near the surface. So, in summary, no local cloud formation and lack of strong winds in the general circulation system to bring in clouds from other places. Looks like we're in for a beautiful sunny weekend. Enjoy, everyone. Now, here's your three-day Vancouver weekend weather summary. Tonight, clear, low of 14. Saturday, sunny, high of 23, 28 inland, UV index of 7 or higher. Saturday night, clear, low of 15. Sunday, sunny, high of 24, 29 inland. Great. So that's your weekend weather summary, courtesy of Environment Canada. Reporting for News 101, I'm Phil Chang. I'm a member of the UBC Storm Club.
Thank you to Phil for that weekend weather update. We will sort out that technical difficulty for our next show. And now it is time for your provincial and national headlines.
A new study led by a researcher at UBC has shown that plastic pollution off the northwest coast of North America is reaching a very high level and is close to the levels found in birds on the notoriously polluted North Sea between the coasts of the Britain and Scandinavia. The study, published online in the journal Marine Pollution Bulletin, examined stomach contents of beached northern fulmars, which are gull-like relatives of albatross, on the coast of British Columbia, Canada, and the states of Washington and Oregon, USA. Northern fulmars forage exclusively at sea and retain ingested plastics for a long period of time, making them ideal indicators for marine littering. Analysis of beached fulmars has been used to monitor plastic pollution in the North Sea since the 1980s. The latest findings, when compared to previous similar studies, indicate a substantial increase in plastic pollution over the past four decades. Stephanie Avery Gom, the study's lead author and a graduate student in UBC's Department of Zoology, and her research group performed autopsies on 67 beached northern fulmars and found that 92.5% had plastics, such as twine, styrofoam, and candy wrappers, in their stomach. An average of 36.8 pieces per bird were found. The average total weight of plastic was 0.385 grams per bird. One bird was found with 454 pieces of plastic in its stomach. The researchers propose annual monitoring of trends in plastic pollution and the effectiveness of marine waste reduction strategies.
A new study by Simon Fraser University researchers has found that there has been a severe decline in the number of sockeye salmon returning to their spawning areas, which will likely intensify the pressure on commercial and First Nation sockeye salmon fisheries in British Columbia. The scientists analyzed 64 independent populations of the species and found that in 24 of them, the productivity of sockeye had fallen substantially since the 1990s in both pristine and heavily disturbed habitats. The remaining areas showed either increased or stable productivity. Dr. Randall Peterman, lead author of the study, said that, quote, "The data revealed that the decline in sockeye salmon productivity is much more widespread than just the Fraser River," end quote. Dr. Peterman also said that northward spread of the decline into Alaska seems to suggest that climate change is a factor in producing ocean conditions harmful to sockeye salmon. While his team could identify no definitive cause of the drop, Dr. Peterman pointed to the growth in population of the Steller sea lion, the spread of marine viruses that affect sockeye, and an influx of competitors like pink salmon as possible culprits of this decline. He also noted that warmer waters tend to be associated with the host of predators that feed on sockeye salmon. Dr. Peterman emphasized that what is most important is that pollution monitoring and research into salmon productivity, both of which have been sharply cut by federal Tories, must continue in order to provide the information scientists and fisheries experts require.
The BC government has unveiled a new repayment assistance program to help university graduates repay their student loans. Student loan payments can now be partially relieved for people whose incomes are above the thresholds of the existing student loan interest relief program. BC Premier Christy Clark announced the new assistance plan on the 25th of June as part of her, quote, Families First agenda. In an email to the UBC newspaper, a Ministry of Advanced Education spokesperson, Baljinder Jacques, said that the repayment assistance program ensures that those paying back student loans will not need to give more than 20% of their monthly income toward provincial student loan repayment. The program is an adjustment to a previously existing provincial student loan relief plan. Under the new plan, those unable to repay their loans can apply for what is called Stage 1 relief, in which the province will pay a portion of the borrower's interest. After 5 years on interest relief, or if someone has been repaying their loans for 10 years in total, they can apply for Stage 2, at which point the government can pay down some of the principal on the loan. If the full amount of the loan is not paid off after 15 years, the government will relieve what remains. But NDP education critic Michelle Mungall doesn't think the new repayment options go far enough. Mungall said, quote, "It's just the re-announcement of an existing program that's had few changes to align. That's had a few changes to align with the federal government program. It's not substantive. It's not addressing the major issues around student debt and affordability for post-secondary education." End quote. Mungall also said her party would prefer to see more money go towards grants that students can apply for while they're still in school, rather than on student loan relief after they're finished.
A group of protesters that blocked a treaty ratification vote on BC's Sliamon Reserve are seeking an injunction to halt the next vote rescheduled for July 10th. Protesters released a statement on June 16th when they blocked the initial vote, outlining their concerns over council spending and the eligibility of voters. The Sliamon Treaty Society and the Sliamon's chief and council have an injunction against the protesters that prevents the group from blocking the polling station for the rescheduled vote. The issue has caught the attention of other First Nations bands in treaty negotiations across British Columbia. Arthur Manuel, a former Nesqualitz chief, along with some Tsawwassen band members, joined the protesters in saying the treaty negotiation processes have been flawed. Mahnult First Nations, a treaty society of 5 First Nations on Vancouver Island, declared their support for the Sliamon Treaty vote. Mahnult and Tsawwassen are the only 2 First Nations that have ratified treaty agreements with the province of the 60 nations in negotiation. If the Sliamon Treaty ratification passes, it will provide 8,300 hectares of land, self-governance, and an approximate $30 million payment over 10 years. Protesters seeking the injunction and the Sliamon Treaty Society will be in BC Supreme Court on Monday for the ruling.
A group of professors and graduate students from the Department of Biology at the University of Ottawa is calling on Canadians to participate in a rally in Ottawa mourning the, quote, death of evidence. The July 10th ralliers will protest what they see as a governmental campaign against science through various program cuts. The rally is designed as a funeral procession with evidence as the deceased. Participants are instructed to wear either a lab coat or black clothing and walk from the Ottawa Conference Center to Parliament Hall. Katie Gibbs, a PhD student in the biology department, will be directing the service. She was at the casual meeting with others in her department when the group came up with the idea to hold a funeral for evidence. According to Gibbs, the group, quote, "felt like we had had enough and that somebody needed to speak out against the cuts to scientific programs. We want to let Canadians know that these aren't just part of regular budget cuts. We think that what's happening here is a systematic campaign to reduce the flow of scientific information to Canadians," end quote. The group was spurred by cuts to programs included in Omnibus Budget Bill C-38, but Gibbs emphasized that this would not be a protest against a specific piece of legislation.
And those are your provincial and national headlines here on News 101. We're going to take a quick break, but do stay with us for your international news brought to you by Democracy Now!
Jazz is a word that means many different things to many different people. The best definition of jazz that I know of is the jazz show on CITR with yours truly, Gavin Walker. Monday nights, 9 to midnight, with the jazz feature at 11 o'clock. Check us out every Monday.
What do you know about bikes? Everything? Perfect. Nothing at all? Even better. At the UBC Bike Kitchen, you can use our space and tools to do your own bike maintenance, get one-on-one instruction on how to fix your bike yourself, or drop your bike off for us to repair. You can also buy a fully refurbished, guaranteed used bicycle, or a variety of new and used parts and accessories. The Bike Kitchen is UBC's non-profit, student-owned, full-service bike shop. We're located in the basement of the Student Union building. Just look for the stairwell on the north side of the sub across from Gage Towers, or search for the UBC Bike Kitchen on Facebook. Stop by the Bike Kitchen and then get riding.
Welcome back to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from the Student Union Building in University of British Columbia. It's now time for your international headlines brought to you by Democracy Now!
Peace Report. I'm Juan Gonzalez, filling in for Amy Goodman. The U.S. and European Union are calling for new sanctions on Syria, similar to those used against the Gaddafi regime ahead of the NATO attack on Libya. At an international Friends of Syria gathering in Paris, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton invoked the threat of Chapter 7 under the U.N. Charter, which ranges from economic embargoes to military force. The news comes as the regime of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad has apparently suffered its highest-level defection to date. On Thursday, opposition activists said Syrian General Manaf Tlas, a member of Assad's inner circle, had fled to Turkey, reportedly over his anger at the Syrian government's killing of civilians. In other Syrian news, the online whistleblower WikiLeaks continues to release documents from the Syria files, more than 2 million emails said to be from Syrian political figures, ministries, and associated companies over a six-year period ending earlier this year. WikiLeaks spokesperson Sarah Harrison said the files would embarrass not only the Syrian government, but many of its political foes.
More than 2 million emails from Syrian political figures, ministries, and associated companies dating from August 2006 to March 2012. This extraordinary data set derives from 680 Syrian-related entities or domain names, including those of the ministries of presidential affairs, foreign affairs, finance, information, transport, and culture. The Syria files shine a light on the inner workings of the Syrian government and economy, but they also reveal how the West and Western companies say one thing and do another.
The Syria files were unveiled without WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, who remains in the Ecuadorian embassy in London, seeking to avoid extradition to Sweden. Harrison read a statement on Assange's behalf.
WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange cannot be with us today, but has given this comment on the Syria files. The material is embarrassing to Syria, but it is also embarrassing to Syria's external opponents. It helps us not merely to criticize one group or another, but to understand their interests, actions, and thoughts. It is only through understanding this conflict that we can hope to resolve it.
Three top figures from Argentina's former ruling junta have been sentenced to additional time behind bars for the deliberate theft of babies from political prisoners. Former dictators Jorge Rafael Videla and Reinaldo Bignone, as well as former Navy officer Jorge Acosta, were found guilty of a systematic plan to take the babies of dissidents and adopt them into military families. All three are already serving jail sentences for other abuses under their regimes. Estela de Carlotto of the Grandmothers of the Plaza de Mayo praised the sentences.
Justicia llegó.
This is justice. It has arrived. Remember that we started in 1996, and at that moment we didn't know whether or not we would ever arrive at this moment and see it in our lifetime. And I think it's healing for all society to know that they are being judged, condemned, and they will continue to be judged and condemned until the last crime that can be attributed to them.
It's believed the Argentine military dictatorship killed at least 30,000 Argentines during its rule from 1976 to 1983. Republican candidate Mitt Romney continues to beat President Obama in the fundraising race. On Thursday, Romney's campaign said it took in more than $100 million in June. Romney is expected to be the first candidate in history to outraise an incumbent president seeking re-election. Speaking in the battleground state of Ohio, President Obama criticized Romney's record on the auto industry bailout and announced the U.S. has launched a new trade complaint over Chinese tariffs.
When the American auto industry was on the brink of collapse, and more than 1 million jobs were on the line, Governor Romney said we should just let Detroit go bankrupt. I refuse to turn my back on communities like this one. I was betting on the American worker, and I was betting on American industry. And 3 years later, the American auto industry is coming roaring back. Just this morning, my administration took a new action to hold China accountable for unfair trade practices that harm American automakers.
During his appearance in Ohio, Obama shared an emotional moment with a supporter whose uninsured sister recently died of cancer. In his address, Obama touted the Supreme Court's recent ruling upholding his signature health care law.
I believe that in America, nobody should go bankrupt because they get sick. I'll work with anybody who wants to work with me to continue to improve our healthcare system and our healthcare laws, but the law I passed is here to stay.
A Florida judge has set a new $1 million bond for George Zimmerman, the Florida man who fatally shot the unarmed black teenager Trayvon Martin. Zimmerman had initially been freed after posting a $150,000 bond, but was sent back to jail for lying about his finances. A record-breaking heat wave continues to scorch the Midwest and could be returning eastward. Weather reports this morning said temperatures in the Midwest could reach the triple digits again, while overnight lows barely drop into the 70s. In St. Louis, Missouri, authorities have reported at least three heat-related deaths in recent days. Meanwhile, hundreds of thousands of homes from Ohio to Virginia still remain without power after last week's violent storms. The extreme weather is part of a pattern that some scientists have described as an early glimpse at the future of global warming. The United Nations is calling for a number of new taxes in a bid to help aid the world's poor. In a new report, the World Economic and Social Survey calls for proposals including taxes on carbon emissions, financial transactions, and on the world's billionaires. Robert Voss of the UN Department of Economic and Social Affairs unveiled the report.
If you tax, by, for instance, 1% the wealth held by billionaires, so meaning everybody holding more than $1 billion in wealth, that would not really affect them in terms of their income, so just the revenue, the income flow they would already have on wealth holding would by far outstrip the tax you would take away from them. So in that sense, it would be another tax, which also makes sense from any economic theoretical argument.
In Bahrain, a child arrested for taking part in the protest against the U.S.-backed monarchy has been sentenced to 1 year of home confinement. 11-year-old Ali Hassan was recently released after a month behind bars. On Thursday, a court ruled he must be monitored at home for the next 12 months.
We were playing soccer and the ball went on the other side where the roads were blocked. While I went to get the ball, there was a private car that came towards me and a person came out running after me. As I tried to run, the person got hold of me. I am a small boy. Why would they keep me under observation for 1 year?
Victims of the 1984 Bhopal disaster have announced plans to appeal a recent judgment dismissing claims against the company Union Carbide and its former chair. On December 3, 1984, around 40 metric tons of toxic gases leaked from a Union Carbide plant in Bhopal. The official death toll stands at around 3,500, but campaigners estimate the actual number is closer to 25,000, with many people still suffering. Union Carbide is now owned by Dow Chemical. A Second Circuit U.S. court recently dismissed an effort to hold Dow and former Union Carbide chair Warren Anderson accountable for the disaster. The nation's largest Presbyterian organization has narrowly defeated a measure to divest from three companies linked to Israel's occupation of the West Bank and Gaza Strip. On Thursday, the Presbyterian General Assembly voted 333-331 to reject a divestment measure. Palestinian solidarity activists say they plan to seek another vote. California has become the sixth and largest state to call for a constitutional amendment that would overturn Citizens United, the landmark Supreme Court decision that paved the way for massive corporate spending to influence elections. On Thursday, California's Senate voted 24-11 to urge Congress to draft an amendment against Citizens United. The measure had passed the state assembly in March. In another vote Thursday, the California Senate passed a bill to help curb the mass deportations of undocumented immigrants who have not committed serious crimes. The California Trust Act would block local law enforcement from turning over immigrants for deportation unless they have been convicted of a serious felony. The bill is California's attempt to push back against the federal Secure Communities program, where local authorities share fingerprints with immigration officials. The federal program helped lead to the record deportation of around 400,000 people last year. Supporters have called the measure in California an anti-Arizona bill because it runs counter to the anti-immigrant crackdowns in Arizona and other states. And the congressional report has found the now defunct mortgage giant Countrywide Financial offered hundreds of discount loans to lawmakers, government officials, and other so-called VIPs in a bid to block legislation that would threaten its profits. The report says Countrywide gave hundreds of loans, often with reduced interest rates or fees, to VIPs, including legislators, their staff, and heads of the government-run mortgage company Fannie Mae. Countrywide played a key role in the housing crash and was once the country's biggest mortgage lender. According to the report, those who received Countrywide special deals were able to influence dozens of legislative measures in the years leading up to the housing crisis. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Juan Gonzalez.
Thank you to Juan Gonzalez and Democracy Now! For those international headlines. For more international headlines, we now go to Free Speech Radio News. Stay tuned for Stranded right after this.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for FSRN. An Argentine court has convicted two former dictators of stealing the babies of political prisoners and opponents, and then often giving them to military families to adopt. Rafael Videla and Reynaldo Bignone were in power during the 1976 to 1983 dictatorship. Videla received a sentence of 50 years for organizing the plan. Bignone got 15 years in part for destroying evidence related to the removal of the babies. Both are already serving jail time for other human rights abuses. The rights group Grandmothers of the Plaza de Mayo estimates 500 babies were taken from their families, but only a few of the children's identities have been revealed. The UN Children's Fund, UNICEF, says child soldier recruitment in the northern part of Mali is happening at an alarming rate. Armed rebels have recruited at least 175 boys between 12 and 18 years old since March this year. In the north, Tuareg rebel groups have declared independence from the rest of Mali, but al-Qaeda-linked militant groups have been challenging them for territory and have already seized control of some towns and implemented Sharia law, according to reports. UNICEF also says they have received reports of at least 8 girls being raped or sexually abused, as well as child deaths due to explosive devices. Nearly 300,000 children have been forced to leave school in the recent wave of instability. UNICEF spokesperson Marizi Mercado.
The numbers are reason for alarm, especially because they represent only a partial picture of the child protection context in the north, an area where access for humanitarian workers is limited.
In addition, the UN says at least 24 suspected cases of cholera have been reported in the city of Gao, one of the towns recently taken by Islamist militants. Refugees at the Jamin camp in South Sudan are dying at twice the rate of the emergency threshold, according to Doctors Without Borders. The camp, which houses about 30,000 people who fled violence in Blue Nile State, is located on a swampy floodplain. Now that the rains have started, the ground is continuously saturated, latrines have overflowed, and contaminated standing water is prevalent. The NGO says there is a shortage of potable water and adequate shelter. Approximately 9 children are dying each day in the Jamin camp, most from diarrhea. Mexico's president-elect Enrique Peña Nieto has been confirmed as the winner of last week's elections after a recount of about half the country's ballots. There have been accusations by the leftist runner-up that the winning pre-party engaged in widespread vote buying. The final result will be certified by September. California's state Senate has just approved a first-of-its-kind immigration bill that pushes back against federal crackdowns on undocumented immigrants. Supporters are calling it the anti-Arizona bill and hope it will serve as a template for other states. For FSRN, Brian Edwards-Tiekert has more.
The California Trust Act blocks local police from referring someone they've detained to immigration officials unless that person has been convicted of a violent or serious felony. It pushes back against the Federal Secure Communities Program, or ESCOM, which has local police send information on people they've arrested to Immigration and Customs Enforcement, then encourages them to hold anyone whose immigration status is in question for possible deportation. Critics say the ESCOM program drives a wedge between local police departments and the communities they serve, making immigrant residents less likely to report crimes and to interact with police. California's move stands in sharp contrast to the direction of more conservative states like Arizona, which has a law forcing local law enforcement to check the status of suspected immigrants detained for offenses as minor as jaywalking. Versions of the California Trust Act have now passed both chambers of the Democrat-controlled state legislature by overwhelming margins. The bill will require a reconciliation vote before it goes to Democratic Governor Jerry Brown for a signature. Brian Edwards-Tiekert, FSRN, Berkeley.
This week, the Occupy National Gathering held its final demonstration in Philadelphia. At the same time, another group held what they call a Continental Congress 2.0. FSRN's Matthew Petrillo reports.
The original Continental Congress met in 1774. A second gathering met a year later, marking the start of the American Revolutionary War. They created a, quote, Declaration of Rights and Grievances and sent it to Britain's king. Continental Congress 2.0, a non-affiliated offshoot of the Occupy movement, met this week with similar ambitions, drafting about 20 grievances. Alex Easton Brown was in the Continental Congress 2.0.
We want the Constitution to be effective, and we want our government to work and abide by the Constitution.
The group and grievances are not endorsed by Occupy Wall Street or the Occupy National Gathering. Still, both seek to ban private contributions to politicians and to reform America's banking system. After the petition is ratified, the group intends to deliver their demands to the three branches of government. Organizers of the new Continental Congress are planning lawsuits against the government if their grievances don't lead to reforms. Matthew Petrillo, FSRN, Philadelphia.
And that's headlines for FSRN. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
Thank you to Free Speech Radio News for those international headlines. More daily headlines and their full newscast can be found at Free Speech Radio News. Their website is fsrn.org. We'd also like to throw a shout out to FSRN's sponsorship drive and their goal of $75,000. Without this, there's a good chance they would be shut down permanently. As our listeners know, Free Speech Radio News is a fantastic progressive news source that provides great international coverage, and we really encourage our listeners to go to fsrn.org to help make sure that you're listening to new, make sure that they continue doing what they're doing. And that is our program for Friday, July 6th. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, get involved with the show, or give us an important news tip, please contact us through our email, news@citr.ca. You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to our latest interviews on our website, citr.ca/news. For more independent news, join us on Monday and Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Chirag Mahajan. Today's show was produced by Chirag Mahajan, me. From the entire news team here at CITR, thank you for listening. And stay tuned for Stranded with your host, Matt Grunland, right here on CITR 101.9 FM.